I'm Brittany Harden-Tengue, a senior manager with KPMG, and I am fascinated by the practice of transfer pricing and its impact on the global market. Join me each episode as I explore the transfer pricing world with specialists who will explain the ins and outs of this niche practice where tax meets economics.
Hi, everyone. My name is Seth Salinger. I'm a manager in transfer pricing in the Minneapolis office and editor of the Exploring Transfer Pricing podcast. This is the second episode in a two-part series on generative AI and similar innovations and their impact on the transfer pricing value chain. As a reminder, we're having a conversation with our host, Brittany, and Lonnie Brist, a senior managing director who has extensive experience in the technology industry, as they answer questions and thoughts from transfer pricing professionals in the field. In the first episode, we cover topics including the allocations of costs and how the generation and treatment of IP should be considered in transfer pricing. This is a continuation of our series, and if you want to, please go back and listen to part one if you want a little additional background. Now let's get into the episode.
Let's make it to the next one. I think we've got lots of good clips to listen to here.
Yeah, I was just wondering, with all of the usage of Gen AI locally by users and the data that gets into many of these agentic AI helps train them. So how in the future are we going to treat sourcing of that? Like, we know sourcing of sales impacts LRD's returns.
Right.
How would the sourcing of this data, which then goes into training the AI, which then impacts the rest of your business, how would that get treated from a transfer pricing in the future, particularly by the local countries?
Let's talk about data. How does this play into the value that's being created?
Data is a very interesting topic, and maybe it's first useful to think about what is the role of data. And usually when we mention the word data, it conjures up a view about value. But yet, I would argue that data has its own value chain, maybe where a data point may not have any value or nominal value. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe not until you get a data lake or a warehouse full of data that has been augmented, that has been cleansed and adjusted, synthesized, that it has value. So first of all, I would say, well, data has an ever-changing value to it, and maybe in its very unfiltered form has little to no value. The other aspect to keep in mind, I think, is that data is just an input into the process. Now, when we think about development spend of a typical IP arrangement, we often think of development as just being a contributor to IP, and we'd have no challenge with R&D being done on a contract basis. Right. So if we think of data in a similar vein, it is simply an input into the overall Gen AI or AI more broadly process. Could that data be contributed or acquired on a contract type return that contributes to the success of AI no different than any other research and development activity?
Data is like a good idea until you do something with it. It is what it is. It's the putting it in context. And exactly like you said, one data point by itself is interesting potentially, but it's not until you manipulate it or you clean it up in such a way or you've compiled it in such a way that you can actually make sense of it. Knowing that if we think about what Gen AI needs to be effective, we know there are some hard inputs. It needs energy, it needs the technology, it needs the prompting, it needs the interface and all of that. But then data does seem like a legitimate input to that. So the line seems to get kind of blurry. And then especially in the context that was brought up here of thinking about LRDs or our limited risk distributors, how they're using that information. What's your impression? Does it come down to a question of who's actually asking the questions of using that? What's the right mix, or how do you think about framing the right mix between who's generating the data, providing it, cleaning it, and then ultimately using it?
You know, this is back to a question of, does an enterprise have a view about its data collection, data use, and the outputs that might come from an AI process utilizing that data. All of this is nothing precisely says when it creates value, but I think each value chain or each enterprise has a view about when that data becomes valuable, and being able to understand that position is a wise thing to accomplish.
All right, let's listen to the next one.
If it's comparable, it's comparable. And if one company is a lot more efficient in performing functions and the cost has been reduced and they don't have the people costs, I don't think that that can be considered purely comparable. So I think it's a little bit how during COVID you had to consider issues. Is this just something that's going on in COVID, or is this a longer term, a bigger issue that's taking place in the industry? And so eventually, I think you'll have to absolutely consider that, because now I don't think a lot of companies, even though they say we're utilizing AI, I don't know if that's actually the case, but I do think that'll have to be something that is one of the functional areas that we'll have to explore, is how much benefit and how much reduction of cost or how much improved efficiency is the effect of AI in your business.
And that's going to be so hard too, because adoption, like you said, has been lumpy, you know, and then how do you even track it? It's not like there's an easy screen. You know, we find, we come up with ways in transfer pricing to find screens that are somewhat appropriate that we feel like are aligned, but this Gen AI thing seems very difficult.
I think it's complicated. And but there's a lot of complicated things, and that's why that's why we get paid all the money we do, right? But you know, if you think about when e-commerce comes out and you've got customers now all over the world, we've had to sort out in transfer pricing, well, how do you actually tax a revenue base in which there's no entity in the local jurisdiction, but there is a million customers? Yeah. And so I think we've had to figure out what to do with digital taxation and how to consider AI in the value chain and as part of the functional benefits that each entity provides. I think it's just going to be part of more complexity.
If all companies are starting to use Gen AI to varying degrees for different functions or services or activities that they're doing on behalf, when does this ultimately affect our comparable benchmarking, our TNMM and CPM sets? Do we got any sort of initial reactions to that?
I think it's always an interesting question when we think about the role AI has on any company. And then when we think about our role of vetting intercompany pricing, and part of that is identifying comparables that are under, and the question is, what are the underlying aspects of that transaction, and can we identify third-party transactions that are reasonably comparable? Now, it's interesting when we think about kind of just the breadth of what that means. And part of my memory goes back to the early 2000s when we had the internet sales. And back then it was a discussion about brick and mortar sales versus e-commerce. And there was a lot of effort being driven into what is the differential between the two. Should one get one return and a different form of selling get a subsequent or different type of return? At the end of the day, it resulted in just a discussion of commerce. There is very seldom a distinction between e-commerce and brick and mortar sales. I'm not saying that there isn't a tax consequence or issues from a direct or indirect tax perspective, but from a transfer pricing perspective, it's just typically viewed as commerce. So all of that comes into play. It's like, yeah, there are going to be some early adopters of AI, some later adopters, some with using AI in greater intensity. Ultimately, it comes down to what is the intercompany transaction in question, and do we have a benchmark for that transaction that is reasonably close or sufficient to determine that it's comparable? So I don't think it ultimately changes how we think about it. And if it's a transaction by transaction, we care about the degree of comparability of that transaction. If you move to more of a profit-driven test, it's going to be whether the functionality, risks, and functions are similar between the tested transaction and the comparables identified. So I think for the most part, the analysis remains the same.
We know there's no such thing as a perfect comparable. If using this type of technology as a point of emphasis that you feel like really differentiates the way that this intercompany transaction is being performed, then just like the same way that you may say the geographic comparability is so important for this particular transaction that we can't just necessarily look at the regional wide set. It makes more sense to look at a country specific comparable. It just becomes another element of understanding that primary tested transaction. And then whether qualitative or quantitative screens is just another element to be considered.
Fully concur. At the end of the day, we have the objective of having the degree of comparability that is supportable upon audit. And, yeah. And so all of those factors come into play.
More likely than not. Awesome. All right, let's hear the next one.
Where does the balance then end up being struck between, you know, where's value being created? How much value is assigned to AI? And where do tax authorities come in for trying to challenge that thinking?
So we've kind of danced around this a little bit, Lonnie, but it's interesting to hear that this is, of course, top of mind for taxpayers that are having to build their transfer pricing policies accordingly. So not that you have a crystal ball, but I mean, what are sort of your reactions? What are some inklings? Where do you feel like there's the most opportunity for this to get challenged?
I think there's greatest opportunity for challenge when companies don't have clear, definitive policies that lay out their intentions. And I would always come back and say, it's a three-legged stool that intercompany transactions should stand on. And one would be the intention of the parties. Number two would be the contractual form, the legal form. And the third would be conduct of the parties. Now, if you have intentions, agreements, and conduct all in alignment, I think the ability for tax authorities to challenge successfully is going to be difficult. Which ultimately comes down to, does the company have a clear intention? Does it have all of its agreements in place? And does it have a clear view followed with conduct? So will there be challenges? I believe there will be, but there will be less so the more you have those three items aligned.
This is a great reminder of no matter how advanced technology gets, the fundamentals of transfer pricing have to come back to those. So while this technology is moving very quickly and people are looking to adopt it in interesting and different and lumpy ways, I know a lot of taxpayers that I speak with are concerned or unsure about how it's going to ultimately play out for them. They've tested it in some ways. It's helped them with certain aspects. But as it continues to roll out, I think just keeping in mind that if this is having an impact on your intercompany transactions in a notable way, to just be upfront about that so that you don't get caught at the end of saying, wow, we've totally revolutionized the way that we've gone about things. But I guess that comes back around to your question of like, what's the right timing on that? And like, when do you actually sit down to revisit that?
So that's a good question. You know, and it's like at the end of the day, I come back and always come. Maybe this is a sign of close to 30 years in the business, but this isn't the first time we've seen technological change. And so you go back, you'd say, well, okay, there was, I had already mentioned e-commerce, and then there was software. And so there was a whole host of things that have evolved over time, going even back down to just software. What was the right time to think about IP from software? Well, the earlier you develop it, maybe at conception, was the better time to ring fence it and have it in a location that you desired. And so the earlier you address it, the earlier you determine who you think the IP owner ought to be, the sooner that one identifies and implements intercompany arrangements that allow for that ownership to be in the location that you desire. And you have the respective remuneration for that development activity paid that is in alignment with your IP ownership. The sooner you have that in place, the less controversy there is when there is exploitation around that. And I don't think today with Gen AI, the concept is any different and the issues aren't any different. The earlier you have the intention of your parties, the arrangements specified as you desire, and the subsequent conduct and precisely the way that your agreements outline, I think you'll have fewer challenges. And so the point ultimately is the sooner one has that intact, the better.
All right. So if I'm hearing this correctly, stick to the fundamentals. The sooner you can think about who is responsible and all of those dempy things that we like to think about, being intentional, making sure that you've got your I's dotted and T's crossed, those intercompany agreements are reflective of what your intentions are as well and what's actually happening. Ultimately, none of this really changes anything. It just is happening at such rapid speed. Is that right?
You hit on a very important part. It's the rapid speed that maybe is different.
Yeah.
And so without addressing that up front and the sheer rate of speed at which activity is occurring, imagine a world where you don't have all of your necessary agreements in place, and maybe we aren't even sure of our intentions. Without any of that in place, it allows for this activity to occur in many, many jurisdictions, maybe without our knowledge, which leads to potentially a view that IP is not centralized in a single location. It could be housed in the various locations around the globe, wherever this activity is at. And so that may be a result of just the speed at which the development or the adoption has come, but something that could be controlled if we could have our clear intentions, have the agreements, and have our conduct all in alignment.
Yeah, I mean, we are talking about ideals here. Someone else earlier brought up the example of COVID. In some sense, you know, the race to find a vaccine to be able to treat and to manage this disease, in some ways, Gen AI is spreading equally as rapidly. And it's a race to try to figure out, okay, how do we effectively manage this, at least from a transfer pricing and tax perspective. So this has been incredibly enlightening. Any final thoughts on this topic, Lonnie, that you want to make sure that we share and include here?
The sooner one can grapple with the control of who's contributing and who's developing, and if all that could be done on a contract basis, then you have a greater ability or a greater propensity to control where that IP is ultimately going to sit. And so the quicker one addresses it, the less controversy I believe you will ultimately have.
With rapid speed, it's just challenging us to move more quickly as well. So got to keep up, got to keep training. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Lonnie. I appreciate you joining me today. And this will be an ongoing conversation. I'm sure we'll have lots more to say as we experience more and learn more. So I appreciate you helping us set the framework here now.
It's always a pleasure, Brittany. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me on this adventure in transfer pricing. See you next time.